This BBC podcast is supported by ads outside the UK.
No fluff, no guessing. When CFA Charterholder is on that resume, it means something real. Intensive study, tough exams, relentless drive, true grit, a strong network. Hiring managers get it instantly. The CFA Charter is more than letters after a name. It's proof of discipline, resilience, and integrity under pressure. It shows who you are before you even walk in the room. Explore what the Charterholder Advantage looks like at cfainstitute.org.
Hello, Greg Jenner here, host of You're Dead to Me. In my new family-friendly podcast series, Dead Funny History, historical figures come back to life for just about long enough to argue with me, tell us their life stories, and sometimes get on my nerves. There's 15 lovely episodes to unwrap, including the life of Ramses the Great, Josephine Baker, and the history of football, plus much, much more. So this Christmas, give your ears a treat with Dead Funny History. You can find it in the You're Dead to Me feed on bbc.com or wherever you get your podcasts.
BBC Sounds. Music, radio, podcasts.
Welcome to The Briefing Room with me, David Aronovich. The Briefing Room is the virtual collective cranium where for 28 minutes we pipe in the top experts on a big question and you and I learn something together. This week, the Channel boat people and other unauthorised entries. How big a problem are they and what are the solutions? As season follows season, summer boats in the Channel led to autumn tough talk at the Tories' virtual party conference. This week, the Home Secretary promised her party she would do something about unauthorised immigration. She's not the first, but what is the scale of the problem and what practical solutions are available? Step inside the briefing room and together we'll find out. First, the view from the cliffs of the south coast. The BBC's Simon Jones has been reporting on the increasing number of people making the journey across the Channel over the summer.
Well, last month was a really busy month in terms of migrant crossings. In fact, a month of records. Now, on one single day, early last month, 416 people managed to reach the UK by boat. And during the course of last month, the total figure was almost 2,000 people. And that is a big increase because that number is higher than the number of migrants who crossed the Channel by boat in the whole of last year. And it's one of these strange things that you can almost predict the numbers who are going to arrive when you take a look at the weather forecast. So when the seas are calm, we often see large numbers set out. I've spent many hours standing up on the White Cliffs of Dover, and from there you can see groups of migrants. In fact, it's become a bit of a spectator sport with people turning up with their binoculars, spotting the boats and seeing them being dealt with by the border force. And I've also been out on the Channel a couple of times and seen firsthand the dangers that people are facing making this crossing. A lot of the boats seem pretty seaworthy. That's because we think the crossings are being organised by people smugglers who are charging people maybe £3,000, £4,000, £5,000, depending on how many people are on those boats and depending on the weather conditions. But they're also people who see this journey is succeeding and trying it themselves. So we've had examples of people coming across in kayaks, we've had examples of people coming across in rowing boats, even using spades to try and row across the Channel. And even in one case, there were some people who tried to get across in a paddling pool. Now, this is, of course, the busiest shipping lane in the world. So it gives you an idea of the risks that the people are taking here. The expanse of the coastline along northern France makes it really difficult for the police and the authorities over there to control. So although the police have identified certain hotspots near Calais, once the police try and crack down on that, then the smugglers organising these crossings and the migrants simply move to another beach. So it really is a cat and mouse game. And there has been real pressure on the French just to try to do more to stop these boats setting off in the first place. The British government has given them a huge amount of money to up the surveillance, but the crossings have continued because there are just miles and miles of coastline in northern France. We've also heard people setting off from further afield as well, from outside of France. A lot of the people, we were told, were coming from Iraq and Iran. We know that a number of Iranians had travelled over to Serbia. They'd given permission to travel without visas. And then, rather than returning, they'd continued their journey to northern France. But over recent months, I think as more and more people have seen that migrants are succeeding in making this crossing, then the reality is a lot of nationalities are trying to do this crossing. We're here from the National Crime Agency. The latest figures show a rising number of people from Africa, such as Sudan and Ethiopia. When we see people being brought to shore, the vast majority of them are young men. We also see some women arrive, we've seen pregnant women, but there's also a number of children who make the journey. They're unaccompanied children. And we've heard here from Kent County Council that so far they've had to care for 400 children who've made the crossing. Here in Kent, the authority has basically said, we really can't care for them safely anymore. And they said to the Home Office, you're going to have to take responsibility for this. This is a real issue that divides the community because a lot of people are saying, what's being done about this? It's something that's very, very visible. People stand on the cliffs, they can see the boats coming in. There are quite a large group of people who turn up at the port every day and they're blogging about this, they're posting footage they film on social media because they think the government should be doing more about it. But then you've got the counterpoint to that. You've got groups who support migrants here in Kent once they arrive, and they're saying, look, you've got to put this in perspective. The numbers arriving are small, they are manageable. They say the reality is, although more people are arriving by boat, fewer people are arriving by other means.
Simon Jones. Let's stand back a little and look at the numbers and what they tell us. How significant are the Channel crossings compared to the overall picture? And over time, what has been the trend? Professor Nando Sigona is Chair of International Migration and Forced Displacement at Birmingham University. Nando Sigona, what sort of numbers of people are crossing the Channel by boat this year?
If you look at the first quarter of 2020, we had less than 200 people crossing. Then it went up to about 2,000 in the second quarter, so by end of June. And then we have had a further increase over the summer months. It's about 5,000 people at the beginning of September.
What increase does that represent on boat crossing over, say, last year?
The number last year were in the hundreds. And it's clear that this is very much also linked to COVID and the pandemic. So what you see is basically the collapse of people applying at airports or at ports. It's very clear that there has been a decline due to the availability of transport over the period of the pandemic. There has been obstacle to movement all the way through, you know, the migration journeys in many ways. You know, it's been more difficult to move through Turkey or any transit country where people would be crossing through to reach Europe. So that is, I think, is the main issue.
So overall, have the numbers stayed the same, gone up or gone down this year?
The latest data we have is at the end of June. We have a decline of around 25% to 30% in the asylum applications in the country.
Is there any way of knowing if the people who are crossing by boat are coming for economic reasons mostly, or for reasons of escaping persecution, i.e. are refugees?
50%, about 2,500 of the people that arrived have had already their asylum claims assessed. And of these, 20% were acknowledged as genuine refugees. 10% got a rejection. And what is interesting is that 70% of this number have been refused their asylum claim, but not because of the validity of the reason, but they are saying that they expect their cases to be assessed by another European countries.
So 20%, definitely we all agree, are refugees. 10% we've decided are definitely not refugees. And 70%, frankly, it's up for adjudication one way or the other.
Yeah, that's correct.
Now, let's put the numbers crossing the Channel into some kind of perspective. How do the numbers crossing the Channel to Britain compare with the numbers crossing the Mediterranean and ending up, say, in Italy or from Turkey into Greece?
If you look at the data for 2020, there have been about 60,000 irregular crossing in the Mediterranean, mostly equally divided between arrival in Spain, Italy and Greece. Nothing like the level that we saw in 2015. You know, you remember that Greece alone received about 850,000 people in 1 year. So the number are much higher in the Mediterranean, even at this point. And if you look historically, clearly the current crossing through the English Channel is relatively small.
How does the UK compare to other similar countries in Europe in terms of how many people in a recent year would claim asylum?
If you do an average of the last 5 years and look at the asylum application, the UK has received around 39,000 asylum applications on average in the last 5 years. Italy has 83,000, France 97,000, and Germany over 320,000 per year as average.
Are the numbers who are successfully granted asylum in the UK very different from those from comparable EU countries?
Actually, it's more or less in line. We know that 56% of this application in the end got accepted and 46% were rejected.
So what we have is a picture whereby the UK takes fewer refugees than comparable countries of the same size and type in Europe, but offers the same proportion right of asylum when they get here. Now, if you look at the overall question of what happens with migration, particularly what we call unauthorised migration, is it more significantly affected by great movements within the world, or is it more significantly affected by the policies that the receiving governments adopt?
This is the, you know, the golden question in migration studies. So the reason why people migrate, they are not really affected by the policy of the Western countries. So if a family needs a member of the family to go abroad and send remittances or need to escape to save their life from persecution, whatever is going to be the policy in Sweden or in Norway really has got very limited impact on the fact that they move. What the policy of the Western countries may affect is maybe which country people end up reaching. So migration policies can affect choices at arrival, but not the motivation for people to migrate to a large scale.
Professor Nando Sigona with the stats and their interpretation. Let's look now at policies designed to affect those numbers, in particular, deterrence to entry. Kathleen Newland has looked at the approaches other countries have taken. She's the author of All at Sea, the policy challenges of rescue, interception and long-term response to maritime migration. And she's co-founder of the Migration Policy Institute in Washington. Kathleen Newland, if we leave morality or perceptions of morality aside here for a moment and just talk about the law, does safety of migrants come first?
Yes, the international law of the sea does make it an obligation for states to instruct the ships that fly under their flag to do their utmost to rescue people. But we certainly have many examples of people awaiting rescue saying that they were passed by ships that paid no attention to them. We've had examples of ships turning off their radar or their radios so that they couldn't receive distress signals. And you know, that's frowned upon.
If you do come across a migrant boat in distress and you pick up the passengers, where are you obligated to take them?
There isn't really much clarity on that. Supposedly, it should be the next port of call, but that doesn't always work. It may be that the next port of call won't accept disembarking migrants. It may be that it's a country where their safety can't be guaranteed, or it may be too far away. I'd say this is probably the most sort of neuralgic point about rescue at sea is the problem of disembarkation.
If people are picked up in your territorial waters, is it the obligation that you have to take them at one of your ports, or can you somehow or other push them off to somebody else's territorial waters?
States make a lot of effort to prevent ships that they don't want to arrive on their shores to keep them from entering their territorial waters. And so you have surveillance, you have the deployment of coast guards and navies. In the mid-90s, when the U.S. was preventing boat arrivals from Cuba and Haiti, they set up what was called at the time a floating Berlin Wall. Ships were so close together and there were so many of them that it was really hard for a boat to sort of slip through this cordon. Now, with more sophisticated technologies, it's even easier for states to spot unauthorized boats that are heading their way and to intercept them before they enter territorial waters.
But presumably that's only where their territorial waters butt onto international waters. Is that still true if their waters butt onto somebody else's territorial waters, like in the Channel?
That's a murkier situation. It would be extraordinary outside of a situation of war or hostilities just short of war for states to push problems deliberately into the waters of a friendly country.
Let's talk about what some countries have been doing by way of deterring migrant boats from entering their waters and coming to their ports. Let's look at the situation in Australia.
Well, Australia has instituted the most stringent policy of any country to prevent unauthorized boat arrivals. They have, particularly since 2013, instituted a policy of interception, diversion, return, and detention, which has made it almost impossible for a boat to reach Australia. And those that are intercepted at sea are taken to a third country, to so-called processing centers on the tiny Pacific island country of Nauru. They used to have a similar center on Manus Island in Papua New Guinea that's now been closed, where people were detained and were given very few options apart from deciding to return to their home country, if that country would have them, and some countries won't accept their nationals back. There is absolutely no path for people who've been detained in Nauru to get to Australia, even if they're found to be refugees.
I presume that a state like Nauru agrees to do this because it's paid by the Australians to do it.
That's absolutely correct. The arrival of boats became a big issue in Australia in the election of 2013. And they did see a sharp spike in the number of arrivals, which became a huge political issue. The government lost that election, and much more stringent measures were introduced after 2013.
Let's switch from Australia to the idea that the UK government has been considering various mechanisms which might in some kind of sense be a bit like what they've done in Australia. For example, there's been reports that the government has considered using Ascension Island as one of these, I don't know what you would call it, detention centres or offshore ferries to process migrants coming by sea. Do you think the model could work here?
I think it's more difficult for Britain because it is not as far from other land masses as Australia is. It would be hugely expensive for the UK to establish a facility on Ascension Island that would come anywhere close to meeting human rights standards. Not that human rights standards have been met in Nauru and Manus, but there is, I think, a reputational risk as well as a huge financial cost of establishing an offshore center. There certainly would be challenges under British law for taking that sort of step.
Now, we've been talking about migration by sea. Are countries more hardline about people coming by sea than they are by other methods?
I think there's something about boat arrivals that creates almost a sort of panic. I don't know whether it's an association with invasion or, you know, loss of control of borders, but maritime migration does seem to generate a much more sort of neuralgic response in governments. Now, that may be because land borders are somewhat easier to control. At sea, there's no possibility of building a permanent wall. You have to maintain a maritime blockade, essentially, every single day. So it's more difficult for countries to control. And the governments have made many more agreements covering land borders and particularly air travel. You know, you can't get on an airplane these days without showing that you already have a visa for the country you're going to, that you have a valid passport. It's more difficult for countries to prevent people arriving at their sea borders than at their land or air borders.
Kathleen Newland. Finally, let's talk specifically about the UK. What levers can a Home Secretary pull, and what happens when they do? Robert McNeill is the Deputy Director at the Migration Observatory, an academic think tank on migration and migrants. Robert McNeill, let's just imagine I'm the Home Secretary and I'm looking at what my predecessors have done and what they've been through. When it comes to channel crossings, I seem to remember we've been here before, but not with boats.
Well, yeah, I mean, this is a situation that in various different ways has been going on for at least 20 years. If we think back to the late 90s, the early 2000s, there was a particular issue with the Songat refugee camp, which was built by the French Red Cross to house asylum seekers, primarily from the former Yugoslavia, who were attempting to reach the UK at that point in time on the Eurostar. There was a perception that the French government was trying to sort of offload asylum seekers onto the UK. And an arrangement was made between David Blunkett and Nicolas Sarkozy, who was the interior minister at the time, to close Songat.
And then it all shifted to ferries and lorries.
Yeah, that's right. I mean, you ended up with this very sort of shambolic shantytown, essentially, that built up, which ended up getting christened the jungle. And that was then focusing on people getting into trucks, people trying to get across, even in tourists' cars occasionally.
And what did my predecessors do about that, still imagining that I'm Home Secretary?
The starting point was to massively increase spending on security. But then also you had the formal, essentially, destruction of the jungle camp.
And did numbers coming through on lorries, etc., significantly fall?
Well, it's very hard to really know because you're trying to measure the unmeasurable. People aren't volunteering to say, oh, I came through on a lorry. We saw what appeared to be a reduction in flows, but that reduction in flows is only based really on interceptions. And then obviously we started to see that instead of a bottleneck, what we had along the, sort of the coast of northern France was essentially a sort of showerhead instead, where you had lots of different nozzles from which people were travelling in much smaller numbers. So consistently you end up moving the problem rather than necessarily ending it.
So as long as the people arrive on the other side of the channel, as you close off one route, they tend to find another.
And that's the challenge with this situation. I mean, I don't have statistics to tell you whether it's safer to come across in the back of a truck or on a small boat, but the presumption is that a small boat crossing is more dangerous. And so you start to create a situation where the more difficult you make it, the more dangerous you make it. Now, of course, that's to some extent entirely the point. If it becomes an unviable option, the idea is that people will not do it.
Now, when looking at the other stratagems that previous Home Secretaries have deployed, I imagine that one of them also was to try and be more accommodating to some people coming over in the hope that that would cut their links with people smuggling and perhaps cut the demand growing up on the other side of the channel.
Well, I mean, we do have the resettled refugee program, which the Cameron administration substantially increased in 2015. And the resettlement program, you have to understand, involves identifying particularly vulnerable people in some of the camps around, for example, Lebanon and Turkey, and providing those vulnerable people with the opportunity to travel to the UK. The government had a target to resettle about 23,000 refugees by 2020, and they've done very well in doing that. But that 20,000 is an extremely small part of the overall number of people who are travelling in order to claim asylum. And they are not the only people who have a legitimate claim for asylum. It only deals with a very, very, very small share of those people who are sitting tight in refugee camps. One thing that it does do is gives you the opportunity as a Home Secretary to point out that you do something well.
Okay. One of the other things that, of course, as Home Secretary, I'm keenly aware of is what people say about the Dublin Accord, essentially the question of where refugees come into Europe and where they end up and the business of them having to claim asylum in the first country they come to. Now, people talk about if the Dublin Accord was more firmly applied, that would mean that Britain would end up with fewer people coming to the UK. Is that true?
Well, one thing to bear in mind, of course, is that the Dublin Accord is an agreement between European Union member states. And as such, the UK is shortly going to be exiting the mechanism that allows it to potentially return people. The Dublin rules are problematic in that they place an enormous strain on the countries that are closest to countries from which people are likely to be travelling, particularly Italy, particularly Greece. And so from that point of view, it is not really something that can be very effectively enforced without putting such an unbearable strain on those countries. So the EU's made an effort to try to spread the burden to some extent and has asked other countries to try to take their fair share. But of course, countries don't want to do that because it's expensive, it's unpopular. And in particular, some of the countries like what they call the V4 countries, so the countries that are sort of in the orbit to some extent of Viktor Orban's Hungary, have been extremely militant about not doing this to the extent that it's become a major sort of rallying call for them.
So, in other words, the Dublin Accord is unlikely to come to my assistance. And in any case, when we exit the EU in the fullest way at the end of the year, we come out of the Dublin Accord.
Indeed.
But how about doing what Hungary's done, which is just to ignore international conventions altogether? What would be the impact for the UK of acting as, say, Hungary has done?
These are effectively moral questions to some extent. You know, do you not have a responsibility to look after the oppressed? And so there's a question of the kind of the self-image of the nation, I think. Would it be something that we could do? Well, of course. I mean, we know that the government can break rules. The government doesn't have to abide by international laws. But it's a question of, you know, what it then does to the nation as a whole. Hungary has achieved a certain international notoriety on the basis of the way that it operates. And I think that if that's the way that policymakers choose to go, it has significant moral and potentially broader implications in terms of the economic relationships that you might have with key other nations.
The perception is that the UK has taken an increasingly hardline approach and numbers coming have fallen. Do you think that we can generally say, therefore, that a hardline approach of itself will lead to falls in unauthorised migration?
Well, I'm not so sure that that's correct. I mean, we don't know whether numbers have fallen or not because we don't have clear data on this. What we do know is that the hardline approach has had problematic trade-offs. The hostile environment policy led to, well, for a start, it led to the Windrush scandal. And I think the reality is that there are trade-offs associated with different ways of doing things. And in time, the Home Secretary is likely to face questions about whether or not they've treated people in a way which respects their humanity.
Now, as Home Secretary, this seems to present me with some insurmountable dilemmas. So I'm going to ask you now, Rob McNeill, I don't want really to get a reputation as being a horrible person or this country as being really horrible country. But on the other hand, I do want to reduce unauthorised numbers. What would you advise me to do?
Well, one of the most important things that we could do is to actually try to improve our understanding of the actual situation. We don't have any solid data about the size of the UK's irregular migrant population. So how can we possibly try to reduce it if we don't know what the actual size is in the first place? And how can we possibly know that any measures that we actually do take to reduce the size of the irregular migrant population have been successful if we didn't have a benchmark for how big that population was in the first place? So the very first thing I think that possibly the new Home Secretary might think about doing is investing in understanding really carefully the size of the UK's irregular migrant population. And if we have that, it's possible that more reasonable and possibly even more humane efforts might be able to be made to address the challenge of irregular migration in the UK.
Rob McNeill, and my conclusion is that short of drastic action with significant moral risks, this is a game of whack-a-mole. You act here, the problem moves somewhere else. And it may not even be that big a problem. My thanks to Kathleen Newland, Robert Neal, Professor Nando Sigona and Simon Jones. We'll be back at the same time next week. You've been listening to The Briefing Room with me, David Aronovich. The producers were Kirsty Knight, Bob Howard and Rosamund Jones. The programme was mixed by James Beard and the editor was Jasper Corbett. Another edition of this podcast will be along again soon, but if you enjoyed it, you may find other episodes interesting, including local lockdowns, what happens if the US election is disputed, and what we've learned about the coronavirus 6 months in. You can find them all on BBC Sounds.
Hello, Greg Jenner here, host of You're Dead to Me. In my new family-friendly podcast series, Dead Funny History, historical figures come back to life for just about long enough to argue with me, tell us their life stories, and sometimes get on my nerves. There's 15 lovely episodes to unwrap, including the life of Ramses the Great, Josephine Baker, and the history of football, plus much, much more. So this Christmas, give your ears a treat with Dead Funny History. You can find it in the You're Dead to Me feed on bbc.com or wherever you get your podcasts.